The story of Scottish pop with Vic Galloway on BBC Radio Scotland.
In this episode, I'm taking a sidestep into the world of dance music. Whether your tastes are for deep bass, something you can shake a glow stick at, or music that'll just get you moving, Scotland has done surprisingly well when it comes to sounds wholly or predominantly categorised by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats. Without Scotland, we'd never have taken the last train to Transcentral. None other than pop provocateurs and conceptual artists, the KLF. Scotland also gave us the Shaman. A group who went from their underground psychedelic roots to number one in the pop charts over a course of only a few years. And of course, we've now achieved global domination in the world of electronic music, thanks to one man from Dumfries, Calvin Harris. As well as the Scottish artists who found success making dance music, central to the culture are the clubs, and central to the clubs are the DJs. Keith McIver is a DJ known as Twitch, one half of the world-renowned Optimo, a legendary night at Glasgow's Sub Club that became a globally renowned tastemaker and influencer. Before Optimo, there was Pure at the venue in Edinburgh. Here's Keith on how that night came together.
I mean, my whole existence, I guess, has been based around being in nightclubs. When I first started DJing and wanting to play the kind of music that I play at that point, nightclubs were, I mean, the idea of two men dancing together or men dancing in a group together even was just, unless you were in a gay club, was just bizarre. Even men dancing was just generally wasn't happening. There was almost no interest in electronic music of any kind.
Tell me about those early days of Pure. It was UFO beforehand, wasn't it?
So initially the idea was a promoter in Edinburgh, this idea to do this night called UFO, and the idea was that there would, like, a band would play first, bands that I wasn't particularly into, but if you went along to see the band, you could stay afterwards, and then it morphed into a club. So I was put together with this other DJ, Andy, Brainstorm, and we'd literally never met until we played on that night. And we kind of learned how to mix records while doing the night, really enjoyed it, but we didn't really have total musical freedom because it was kind of based around this band concept. After about a year of doing that, the Paris Angels played, and the club had kind of been taken over by Hibs Casuals, and it was in their part of the town. So if you weren't Hibs Casual, you were welcome, but if you were a Hearts Casual, you most definitely were not welcome. And I think for some reason Paris Angels had a big following of Heart supporters, so they all came along, and just as they were playing the encore, the lead singer made some comment about FU Hibernian, and it was a riot. I've never seen, it was like something from a Wild West brawl. There was tables and chairs flying through the air, people, like, bodies flying through the air. Eventually the police came, told us, you can't do this anymore, this is just not gonna happen. So we kind of thought that was all over, thought about it for a few weeks, and then went back to the police and asked them if we could start it again, but as a membership club, so we could control who came in. They agreed to let us do that. We called the night Pure. It was like a year zero. We started to only play the music that we absolutely wanted to play, and it was a case of really being in the right place at the right time when techno house, the whole rave thing exploded, and we were maybe the first club there primed to ride on the coattails of that.
A key element to the explosion of house, techno and rave culture that Keith mentions were the live acts. Two very different acts were Finny Tribe and the Time Frequency. Here's Davey Miller from Finny Tribe.
We weren't musicians at all. We weren't able to play anything. We found instruments, we picked them up, we hit them, or destroyed them.
People used to dream about the future.
We would have a percussion kit of sorts, but that would be made up of bits of railings, things that we found. We found scaffolding poles. We kind of cut them down into tubes of different sizes.
People used to dream about the future.
Teletopia, Technopolis.
And we did have conventional instruments to a degree, but then we kind of turned that on its head. It was boring. A lot of the bands in Edinburgh were guitar bands, and we didn't want to be a guitar band. We wanted to find different ways of making music.
You were kind of maybe grouped in with that industrial tag a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And was that something that you were comfortable with?
I think, yes. It was an interesting way of making music. We started off as a conventional band, got sick of that. We actually threw all the instruments away and did performance art. We were called art terrorists. There was a thing, art terrorism, Liebach, test department. We enjoyed hitting bits of metal.
Yeah, and there was always a sort of visual representation to what you did as well. How important
was
that?
Yeah, I mean, Andy was at art college, so yeah, we made films and we covered ourselves in paint. We cut ourselves open with knives. We wore nappies on stage.
Just a normal Saturday
night. Just a normal Saturday night.
Bomb, bomb, bomb. It didn't go woo, it went
John Campbell there, producer and musician you might know as the Time Frequency.
At 14, I've got my first synthesizer from the Barras, and it only did two sounds because the waveforms were broke. It was very much bomb, bomb. It didn't go woo, it went woo. So my songs had to be played slightly. It was weird. I got a tape machine from the Barras also, and because this thing, the envelopes were so slow, I had to play everything in advance and hope that it would land in time, if that makes sense. I was making electronic dance music from a very young age. Before raves, There was like Eurobeat, which has got high energy. It was really strong in the gay scene, and I was drawn to that musically because it was electronic and it was upfront and hard, and I really liked that. So I was making stuff that probably about 87, 88 that was quite hard and aggressive. And all my friends thought it was garbage. I remember when in East End, they all said, oh, this is just terrible. You should listen to this Acid House. And of course, I heard Acid House, and I was horrified when I heard Acid House. It was just, the music was just ugly. I just hated the sound of it. And hate is a strong word, but Acid House to me has no redeeming qualities. And I don't know if there's acid parties still going on to this day, but I felt the music was based around a frame of mind as opposed to music.
Two people that definitely did hear the redeeming qualities of techno were Ord Miko and Stuart McMillan, also known as Slam. Here's how they first came to the music.
A disco chart countdown that I used to listen to on a Saturday morning on some channel, I can't remember, and started hearing a lot of kind of like disco and kind of soul before you kind of heard it on kind of mainstream radio. It's very strange to come across it. A kind of meandering into kind of synth pop and Kraftwerk. A lot of record shops in Glasgow I used to visit, you know, the early FOP that started up in a small unit in De Courcy's Arcade, and it's a bit of a vinyl junkie, you know, and that was where I used to head on a Saturday morning, was to go and try and dig out stuff that I kind of either heard of the band, the label, or what have you. And
the record shopping thing was key. You would often develop a rapport with the guy who worked behind. You know, if you bought a lot of records, like I also bought a lot of records, I was kind of spending a lot of my pocket money on records.
A generation later, Auntie Flo, or Brian D'Souza to give him his Sunday name, also got the bug for records. They weren't necessarily auspicious or grand beginnings, though.
I'd got the turntable and started to buy records at quite a fast rate when I was in my teens. At some stage, I realised that there was a thing called DJing. Didn't quite know what it was, but I knew that it's kind of something attracted me to it. And I remember telling my mum, "Mum, I think I'm going to get a second turntable." She says, "Why do you need that?" And I said, "I actually don't know, but it looks like the thing." So I saved up and I got two turntables and a small crappy mixer.
Auntie Flo is one of the people behind the High Life parties.
The musical ethos for us was to explore music that we felt that we weren't hearing enough. There was a lot of great music in Glasgow, but there was a certain global scene that was developing where you had this kind of cross-pollination of sounds via the internet and producers in Latin America and Africa that were making amazing music that we were just discovering for ourselves. And we thought, wow, it'd be great to be able to have a club night where we could play all this music. And it was just a slight point of difference to maybe some of the other clubs that were out there. Not as a slight to them, it was just as in, let's present something that's a bit more, it's just new and unique for us, and let's see if people respond to that. And, you know, luckily enough, they did to a certain extent. You know, High Life is still running, well, eight years later.
What about growing up on the Isle of Skye? I mean, was music a part of everyone's day-to-day life?
I suppose the principal strange thing was, until I was about 12, we couldn't get Radio 1 until they put up a big booster mast over in Noida. So we listened to Atlantic 252 on Longwave, which was primarily a soft rock station. That was probably the biggest influence of all on me and the sounds, you know, compounded by much later in life when I was briefly living in Los Angeles as a student and discovering the classic rock things there. Certain tracks, like Bette Davis, I ended up sampling, which is obviously a very famous big hit over here, but it's not part of the, it's not on the radio every time you turn it on the way it is in the States. That was, it gave me a different perspective.
Miles McKinnon, or Milo, destroyer of rock and roll, discussing what opened his young ears up to dance music. A young Calvin Harris was rejected by Milo's record company, Breastfed Recordings, although I don't think that held him back. Here he is talking to me about some of his original inspiration and musical influences.
I started off listening to Nirvana when I was eight, because my big brother loved them, and Pearl Jam and stuff, when I didn't really know if I liked it or not. I was just listening to it.
I find that quite interesting. So you start with kind of, you know, grunge, noisy stuff.
I got a wee acoustic guitar for my Christmas. And, you know, it was the classic wood colour of acoustic guitar. I used to learn Lithium was the first little thing, like the bass line to that. And I painted my guitar black, which worried my mum slightly. And that thing, it just got me into bass lines, and any tune with a good bass line. I got really into Jamiroquai as well. Stuart Zender, like the virtuoso bass player that he is, had like Emergency on Planet Earth era Jamiroquai was unreal. Like, it still is, it's amazing. I got into them, then I got into the Spin Doctors, because their bass player was almost like a level 42.
Yeah, Mark slapping King. And yeah. Popping. Yeah.
He went for it, and that just fascinated me.
One thing you'll know about dance music is that it doesn't stand still. Young producers are always innovating while discovering new sounds and techniques, including using YouTube and the internet in general. Here's Sam Gellatry, a young Sterling Electronica producer whose music has gone global while still being only 21 years old.
The funny thing is, though, I've been making music for like 8 years, and I was exposed to that because my brother would do it on the same laptop, so it'd be like there to use. So I got into Daft Punk like around 10 years ago and started liking like disco and all that stuff, and then sample it on YouTube, which was literally just coming up as well. So Like, I was born at the perfect time for it to be something which was like a hobby, which would just turn into something which ultimately brings me here. So it's amazing, man. Like, the difference in the songs I make now from before is just so, like, it just shows the maturity that I've had from starting at a young age and then, like, growing up with it, you know what I mean?
I'm Vic Galloway, and this is the story of Scottish pop. We've already heard from a broad range of people involved with dance music in Scotland over the last 30 years or so. Even within the church of dance music, there's countless different micro-genres and styles. But one thing that certainly unites all dance music is where it's played, the clubs. And it was the clubs that inspired Primal Scream's transformation from retro indie rock and roll band to something a little more modern.
Can you describe what it felt like to be going to those clubs for the first time and experiencing that scene?
The energy in the clubs was incredible. In British youth culture, you know, if you wanted high energy, it was in the acid house clubs. It wasn't happening in indie rock. You know, I went to a lot of those gigs. You know, there was a lot of good American bands at the time. Sonic Youth, Dinosaur and Henry Rollins, and you know, there was a lot of good stuff coming over, but the bands were great, but in the audience there wasn't a lot of energy there, you know. And then you walked into an acid house club and the whole place was going bonkers. It was like early rock and roll, you know. It was insane. It was like, it was just crazy, you know. And everywhere you looked, people were just going mad, you know.
Heard from Keith McIver earlier, the club he ran, Pure, has its own place in Milo's heart too.
When I was in Edinburgh, about 17, used to go to Pure at the venue, which was a Twitch and Brainstorms night long before Twitch moved over to Glasgow and started Optimo with Johnny Wilkes. So I've been kind of a devoted follower of Twitch for the best part of 20 years now.
I went to Pure as well. I remember it. I remember it well, or not.
It was a real taps off party. Yeah, quite embarrassed to think of a sweaty 17-year-old me.
Someone else in the sweat fest that was Pure was Claire Sterling's mum and dad. Here's Claire, now known as Lucky Me DJ and producer Eclair Fifi, to explain.
They used to go to a club called Pure, Twitch and Brainstorms night before Optimo started. They used to record all the nights and my mum onto cassette tape, and my mum and dad would take those tapes home and give me them. And I think I must have listened to the first ones when I was about 9 or something on my Walkman. And it was like I was exposed to people like Andy Weatherall, Derek May, Wan Atkins. Like, I couldn't rebel against that. It was too cool.
That's The Testimony by Finny Tribe, a song that put them firmly at the forefront of European dance culture. Here's Davey Miller from the group.
Pete Tong got in touch and went, this record you've done 2 years ago is now huge in Ibiza. We had no idea what Ibiza was. We had no idea what acid house was. We'd started to use samplers and things, and we'd started to work with different instrumentation, but we didn't know what acid house was. And then all of a sudden, The Testimony was all over the clubs. If you actually listen to the track, it's not a pleasant track to listen to. For some reason, it fitted in with all this other Balearic music which Alfredo began to play in Ibiza, and hit a chord.
Did you ever go over to Ibiza and sort of hear your own records through the sound systems?
No, we didn't. We were invited by Danny Rampling to Shume after Danny came back from Ibiza, that first summer in Ibiza, and he invited us down to Shume, and it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen in my life.
House music all night long.
Say what?
House music all night long.
Say what?
House music all night long.
Say what?
House music all night long.
A whole load of young people, without any pretense, just having an incredible time to music. It wasn't cliquey, it was just sweaty, and they would dance to anything. They were just having an incredible time. And this was Shume. So Shume started, I guess, the acid house movement in the UK, although people in Manchester would probably say different, but Shume was one of the first clubs that I went to, and it was just an extraordinary occasion.
For Stuart McMillan, Ord Meikle and Auntie Flo, their forays into clubs and DJing go hand in hand with where they're from.
Glasgow's always loved dance music. You know, when the whole house music explosion happened, you kind of knew that you were in another revolution. You know, you kind of knew this was a musical revolution at the time. And I know that sounds, you know, a lot of people say, oh no, we didn't really realise what was happening. But the energy and excitement at that time as a young 20-year-old guy was something that will never be repeated and hasn't been repeated. You could hear, almost like in the space of weeks, there was a change in music, and we were kind of at the front of that. And it was, you know, you'd see cars go by and house music would be blaring out the cars. It was just a general buzz around the town. Everything changed.
It felt new, but I also felt that, you know, that Glasgow had such a kind of good club scene, and it's always been quite an early adopting kind of city. You know, so you were hearing new stuff pretty much every week in different clubs and what have you. But I think, as Stuart said there, this definitely felt kind of, you know, that something new had happened. Didn't feel like there'd been nothing before, though. You know, it felt like it was a bit of a kind of watershed moment. And you know, obviously hearing the kind of early kind of techno releases out of Detroit and Chicago.
It definitely was something which grew quite quickly, and I remember a girl said to me, and we started doing maybe two or three nights in the sub club, and a girl came up and said, "What are you going to do when this stops?" And I kind of just thought to myself, "What this stops?"
I was a complete novice when I first started going out. I didn't have a clue. It seeps into your conscious that there's a club called The Arches that exists, and there's a club called The Sub Club that exists. I remember talking to my mates, let's check these clubs out. We didn't know what we were going to do, so we decided, you know, we'll go to one week at The Arches, Friday night, which was Colours, and then the next week we'll go to Pressure. And we're literally just doing a A-B test of which what was better, and it was like an experiment. We went to, like, me and my three mates, and we absolutely didn't know what to expect, but it was so exciting. It was so exciting to stand in that queue and hear the bass coming out of the club, step into the unknown, colourful characters in the queue, not sure if we're going to get in because we're underage at that time as well, and then, like, stepping into the club and just like, wow, this is just like so intense. The experience, just the, you know, how it hits your senses is just incredible. You know, the darkness, the loudness, the full-on bodily impact of the sound and stuff like that, you know, it was just like, boom, this is amazing. I picked Pressure and I picked Slam, by the way, so they were a big inspiration of henceforth after that. I got into Soma Records, I met some people at Soma, I started going down to the nights at Alaska. Literally, religiously was there Friday, every Friday night for Silicon Soul, most Saturday nights for when Slam was doing it, and shortly after that was like, oh, let's try the Sunday. So then you get into Optimo and you're like, wow, Optimo, this is another thing altogether, you know, what the hell is this? Like, how can they do this when we're just so used to the full-on clubbing experience, and you got Optimal just playing completely everything? And I was like, well, that's another like twist. So this thing just seemed like it was expanding like beyond all comprehension.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
On our second Primal Scream album, we didn't exactly got great press in it, and the only good press we got was from Andy Weatherill in the Boyzone, where he listed it was his favourite records of the summer, and he put down the ballads on the second Primal Scream album. You know, we used to go and see him DJ around London, and during 1989, and became friends with him, and then I think Andrew Innes, our guitar player, came up with the idea of asking Andy to remix a song from her second album called I'm Losing More Than I'll Ever Have.
That became Loaded, basically.
That became Loaded, yeah. And the idea was to make it a track that they would play in the clubs that we were going to, the Acid House clubs, because we were going to Acid House parties all the time. And we took enough drugs and hung a bit with them so long that we started liking the music.
Bobby Gillespie brings up an issue some people might think is synonymous with dance music and culture, drugs. That's not necessarily so, though. Here's Keith McIver again.
I mean, it was very noticeable to me because at that point I was completely straight edge. I didn't drink, I didn't take in, I smoked cigarettes. That was my only vice. So I was very aware of just how high everyone around me was. And I would say in the first couple of years, 95% of the people there were probably taking ecstasy and either a lot of it or very strong ecstasy. So the atmosphere was crazy because it was also new to people. One, the drug was new. It was breaking down social barriers. People from all sorts of different backgrounds that would never have been in the same room together were meeting and dancing. Men were dancing with men were dancing with women. It was all getting very mixed up. It didn't matter what racial background, sexuality you were from. So it really felt like it was almost revolutionary, but it also felt incredibly hedonistic, which was good for the atmosphere, but it was also a little scary, and I was a little glad when after a few years it did calm down a bit.
For a musician, DJ and music producer, success can come in many forms. Here are Twitch and Milo recounting some memorable nights.
I've played gigs where I've just been literally in tears from the response of the crowd. It's been so emotional. Also, sheer terror. We played the closing party at Sonar last year, and I don't think Johnny and I quite realised how big. We thought maybe there'll be a couple of thousand people there. Walk out on the stage and it's 25,000 people. I had to give like Johnny a 5-minute pep talk because he was so nervous beforehand, things like that. But then you can feel the love and energy, and it's such an overwhelming experience. People ask how you can still be interested in doing this. I might have been doing this over 30 years, but things like that, it's such a seductive thing. Sharing music you love with a whether it's a tiny audience or a huge audience, it's something I could never imagine ever tiring of doing.
What did you play to make 25,000 people all dance at the
Slayer
same time? Slayer.
It was right at the end, and played this shortened version I'd done of Angel of Death, which, I mean, I'm not a massive Slayer fan, but that song just sounds absolutely insane. There's a few second pause while everyone's standing there going, what the hell is... And then suddenly the whole place just... People are like stage diving, going absolutely crazy. And then obviously some people are hating it, just standing there with sheer consternation. But I think sometimes if hating something's okay, loving something's okay, if people think something's just okay, that's never really enough for me.
Yeah.
Strong opinions either way are good.
Probably my favourite night was I was actually in the crowd. There was when I I came to stay with some friends in London around 2003 in this manky warehouse in Dalston. And I mean, my friends in London were not particularly clubbers. They were more like art school guys. But this was a club night they really want to go to. And they were putting on a big one of those. So Errol opened, followed by Glimmer Twins and Soul Wax. Obviously, they weren't all listening to each other's sets. So I was there in the crowd and I got to hear Drop the Pressure, you know, three times in the course of 3 or 4 hours. It got the desired reaction every time. So,
and were you grabbing people and saying, "That's me, that's my record"? You are a definite bona fide pop sensation.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Now, how do you feel about that? Is that still something that you kind of want to move towards the production thing?
Yeah. A pop star, I see, you know, Justin Timberlake, Madonna, Britney Spears. I'm not one of those people.
Well, I don't, but, you know, people will see you in exactly the same light. They're buying the records or downloading the tracks in their hundreds of thousands. You're going to number one. You are a pop star, whether you like it or not.
That's not true. Eric Prydz got to number one. He's not a pop star, he's a producer. I'll always make my own music. You know, I think if I was going to really go for it, I'd go to other producers or something, you know, and I'd go to a dance class and singing lessons and you know, train and stuff. And I'm not interested in that. Like, I do music. I know what I'm good at. I'm good at that. I'm happy to say that I think I'm good at making music.
That was me talking to Calvin Harris in 2009 on the release of his second album, Ready for the Weekend. By that time, his star was already very much in ascendance. Tell us about the album An Unexpected Groovy Treat, which, as far as I know, is your most successful record.
Yes, very much. That came from our most productive period with One Little Indian. It was the second album we made for One Little Indian. We had agreed that Andrew Weatherall would remix 101. We were delighted with it, absolutely delighted with it. It retained so much of the original, and it allowed us the identity we needed to be happy with it. And we worked then with people like Youth, and we worked with Justin Robertson. We went to Manchester a lot. We played the Hacienda. Unexpected Groovy Treat. It had three big tunes on it. It had 101, it had Ace Love Juice, it had Forever Green. All which were internationally massive club hits. Forever Green came out as three 12-inch singles. It was probably the record we sold most of. It was huge, it was number one club hit all over the world. It was a very productive time and a great time. We toured it. We had a wonderful relationship with One Little Indian at that time and a very good record.
And Weatherall was the hottest guy around at that time. I mean, he'd done Screamadelica and so on. And if you had him attached to a track, it would quite often help it, certainly in clubland.
Yeah, and the thing with Andrew is, to this day, is that he doesn't do anything that he doesn't like. He won't take the money. His ethics and his ethos worked with ours, and that we enjoyed working with him, and he made a great record.
What was Scotland's reaction to you like? What was Edinburgh's reaction to you like?
We made a record. It has a refrain in it called "Who the Hell Do You Think You Are?" Just who the hell do you think you are? It was a kind of response to what I think people in Edinburgh thought of us.
Really? Did you get that?
Oh, yeah.
Did you get that Scottish envy?
I think we were kind of a bit of a gang, so there were six guys. I guess we were quite confident, and people would say, "Who the hell do you think you are?"
Turn it into a song.
Turn it into a song, yeah. Turn it into a sample. I mean, we were different to most bands in Edinburgh, I think, or maybe even most bands in Scotland. There weren't that many electronic music acts.
The Time Frequency found their own success, and you can still hear how proud John Campbell is.
1982, Livingston Forum, and the Scottish charts had only just been invented at the time. And the very first version of Real Love went in at 5. I mean, people might say, oh, you're big in Stony Bridge or, you know, big in Japan. I don't care. You know, I'm proud of my country. So my Scottish charts mean more to me than the English charts or the British charts, however you want to call it. That's just how I feel about it. That's the way I feel, you know. To go in at number 5, suddenly overnight, had changed me from being the dreamer to the impossible dreamer who's going to make reality. And that was a really weird thing for me to deal with. Particularly, I was just about to go on stage. I only found out late into the night, and I was like, we're actually in the chart. Oh my God. And I couldn't take it in, you know, it was like bizarre. First one is New Emotion. Having been hovering around the top 40, sitting at 46, 42, 41, I'd been hovering around that top 40, man. I'd been dying for weeks going, it's a nail biter. And it stayed. It stayed at 41, and I thought, I'm cursed, it's over. And then lo and behold, one Sunday night, Mark Goodyear announced it, and we'd went in at number 37. And he said, and the way he said it, it was like, he said, they've done it, they've made it. The Time Frequency around the top 40. And instantly, like the child that I am, I just burst into tears because it'd been my life's work.
Slam have found fame as world-class DJs, and Stewart and Ord are also central to the record label Soma Quality Recordings. But how did French electro house pioneers and now huge pop stars Daft Punk get involved with an upstart Glasgow dance label? Stewart and Ord pick up the story.
They'd like one of the releases, hadn't they?
Yeah, they, I think they liked, I think they
tracked us down.
They liked Positive Education as a track, so they wanted to meet us. They gave us a cassette, and we were in someone's flat in Paris, and they put the music on
Ghetto Blaster
on a Ghetto Blaster, and it was just so raw. I think we signed the EP in the flat. We're like, yeah, we'll put this out,
yeah,
you know,
men,
but we'll do this, and you know, the track Alive, which made it on the first album, that's actually was on the first tracks that we heard. I just wish we could have sort of hung on to them, really. I mean, they were
ka-ching.
Yeah. They had a commercial value, which probably makes me the worst A&R man in the world. I certainly couldn't see it at the time.
I don't think they possibly foresaw, you know, how kind of popular they became. It was Da Funk that kind of, the track that kind of broke them. It used to happen.
Which, incidentally, I didn't like.
No,
you know?
No.
I was like, that sounds a bit cheesy. Yeah, I don't like that. You know, which shows you what a terrible A&R man.
So Daft Punk nearly didn't happen. With Daft Punk, it was one of these records. There were a few around in the 90s where just a whole load of different types of DJs from different genres picked up on it, you know?
Mm.
And you would hear everyone from Kevin Saunderson to, God knows, Mixmaster Morris play. It's just a bizarre spectrum. From that moment on, every record company you've ever heard of in the world were phoning the label, sending Thomas faxes. Yeah. They were being offered any kind of deal they wanted. It was an A&R man's kind of dream. We couldn't hold on to them. You know, they had their own vision. We're happy to have been kind of a small part in their story, to be honest.
But, you know, where they moved to and what they did later on probably wouldn't have fitted with their musical direction anyway, so...
Your A&R policy would really have kicked in.
Yeah, no, I would have been, yeah. Stuart doesn't like it, it's a hit. One more time. I got the feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time. This got the feeling so free. We're gonna
The Scottish Album of the Year, or SAY Award, has always championed electronic nominees. In 2016, electronic composer Anna Meredith took the award. Anti-Flow has been nominated twice, and here he is, reflecting on Anna and her winning album, Varmints.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, she's obviously got a classical music background and training, and she's applied that into experimental electronic production techniques, etc. We were talking about this on the way up, you know, the cross-pollination of genres and how kind of the traditional notions of genres are less relevant today than they've ever been before. You know, Anna's a good example. How do you categorize Anna's music? You know, it's very difficult. It's, you know, lots of people ask me, like, what is your music? Like, I, you know, often it gets categorized in a certain way, but it's never exactly that, is it? The most recent past that Scotland has for music certainly should recognize electronic music in general.
And how is life post-Varmints winning the SAY Award and getting so many plaudits and critical acclaim and selling loads of copies, I'd imagine, as well?
It's been amazing, really hectic. You know, all these gigs that are now part of my life, nearly one a week, which is, you know, means that putting all my clarinets and my glockenspiels in a giant economy suitcase and travelling on some miserable airline has become like part of my sort of regular week. And every single time we're at a check-in desk and they look at this cello, because I didn't know this till I was doing this stuff, but you can't take a cello in the hold, you have to stick it on a plane and sit it next to you. And every single time we do, it doesn't matter how much you've got the paperwork, they go, nah, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And then there's a silence as they tap 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 and go, oh, hang on, tap tap tap, oh yeah, okay, you can do that, tap tap tap, oh yes, you have done that. But it's just this thing that, you know, it's coming, it's there, it just seems to be part of the process. It's this miserable passive aggressive standoff.
SAY Award-nominated Hudson Mohawk is now one of the most successful electronica and hip-hop producers in the world, making beats for Kanye West, amongst others.
Let the suicide doors up. I threw suicides on the tour bus. I threw suicides on a private jet. You know what that mean, I'm fly to death. I step in Def Jam building like I'm this shit. Tell them give me 50 million or I'ma quit. Most rappers taste level ain't at my waist level. Turn up the bass till it's up in your face level.
Here's Martin Flynn from the Lucky Me label talking about his formative years of spreading the word.
The Hudson Mohawk thing was definitely part of this sort of first wave social media MySpace boom. There's a lot of artists that came out of that who spread really quickly because of the community that was there. You know, that's how social media in 2018 is a very different thing, and it's a lot more cynical. At the time, it did feel like the first time outside of these forum communities and online things, you know, like swapping tapes via email lists and little basic internet, old internet communities. It was the first time I felt like a lot of folks connected. It wasn't like a one scene thing. It wasn't one sound of music. There was a lot of artists and a lot of people that came out around the same time who, you know, are big players nowadays.
I think he's just a unique, amazing producer that created his own sound. It's just raw talent. He kind of creates like a world. Like when you hear his music, it's very visual. He's still got that sort of magic.
Eclair Fifi talking about Hudson Mohawk's unique sound. Lucky Me and Numbers are the new face of Scottish electronic music, looking forward and blazing a trail with innovative releases, artwork, parties and club nights. Another couple of pioneers when it comes to dance music have to be Stuart and Ord from Soma Quality Recordings, the team that almost didn't bring you Daft Punk. Here are their thoughts on branching out from DJing to running a label.
You didn't want people necessarily to understand it and for it to have kind of mass appeal. That wasn't a judge of the quality of it. And it was just a kind of self-belief that this kind of music was was worthy of kind of, you know, people kind of listening. And I think, you know, with Soma, a lot of people just simply, you know, didn't understand it, thought that house music might be a flash in the pan or dance, and or a lot of people were kind of a little bit older that were involved in the industry and had really not come across it. Or
yeah, people don't believe me when I say this, but there was really no kind of grand plan for
Still
Soma.
Isn't.
It was one of these kind of situations where we wanted to make music, and really it was just a vehicle for us initially to put our own music out. It was fiercely independent at the beginning because we were kind of stamping the records ourselves. We had no artwork for the first release, and I think we had a little go at distributing the records as well. And we kind of got burnt pretty quickly with that, and we kind of sort of realised that, all right, hang on a minute, we need a bit of help here.
The move from DJing to individual production to starting a record label seems to be a common one. Keith McIver again.
I mean, the producer thing kind of happened by accident. I kind of dabbled with it with a friend, and we had a project in the early 2000s. We were signed to Matador Records. And then just as a result of that, because people knew I made music, I would just get asked to do remixes. And I never really set out to be a remixer, but so many things that I thought were great, people then get in touch and ask me, and I ended up doing 100 remixes. I think when we stopped the weekly club, it just freed up a lot of time. We put so much love and energy into doing Opto every week that it completely took over our lives, which was the main reason it stopped, because I wanted to try and have the time to do other things. So around the time that stopped, started Opto Music, which to this day I still say it's my hobby, but that takes up almost all my free time. It's about to come up to its 100th release.
If you're wondering why a DJ or musical act might not want to work with bigger labels, Davey Miller and Finny Tribe's experience might shine a light on things.
We did leave One Little Indian under a bit of a cloud because they remixed one of our records to a point where we said, well, you're not releasing that. We're not happy with that. That doesn't represent us at all. So we left. People don't leave record companies. We left. Mm. We set up our own one and we started releasing our own records again.
Yeah, well, Finny Tribe has become a kind of cottage industry in a way. You've got the band, you've got the studio, and the label. What went into that, and why did you decide to do that? Obviously, leaving One Little Indian was one of the...
Well, we'd already had the studio. We'd invested money in the studio. We kind of lived and worked there, and it was a cottage industry. We had a printing company, so we made our own T-shirts, made our own posters, we made our own records, and we were very kind of self-sufficient. Obviously, having a record company coming along and signing you gives you some money, gives you some freedom, but it also kind of restricts you in many ways. So leaving One Little Indian, we wanted to kind of recapture our independence. We wanted to be independent again, so we just started making records again. But we were in an industry. London Records came along and then signed us again. So we signed another big record deal when record deals were ridiculous and incredibly restrictive. You couldn't sneeze without spending £1,000. We lost our way, I think, because of the industry.
Although musically you didn't necessarily...
No, we didn't. But I think it made things very difficult because there was always somebody on your shoulder going, well, perhaps if we did it this way, or perhaps if we do it that way, it'll be better.
And you guys had your own vision?
Yeah, we had our own vision, and it became harder and harder to have our own vision and release records the way we wanted to release them.
Calvin Harris passed on early demos to Breastfed Recordings. In some ways, certainly his early releases, I think, doffed the cap towards Milo. What do you think of his amazing rise to success?
I think it's fantastic. I think I'd be the last person to have the perspective to judge whether he was influenced by me.
I think he's the greatest brand that Scotland's ever produced besides Iron Brew. I liked him before he got the teeth and the tan. I liked all that kind of... I loved Acceptable in the 80s. Great, man. I got love for you if you were born in the 80s, the 80s. I've got hugs for you if you were born in the 80s, the 80s. Calvin stuff has made it in America. He's took the ball and ran with it. So more power to the guy.
A slightly reticent Milo and a not at all reticent John Campbell giving a couple of thoughts on one of Scotland's greatest musical exports. Calvin is now the most successful male pop star in the USA since Michael Jackson. Someone, remember, who was stacking shelves in a Dumfries supermarket in the mid-noughties. One thing that's obvious about dance music, EDM, clubbing, and the culture that surrounds it in Scotland is that it's in rude health. Music. Electronic music has only been around for 40 years or so. But as we look towards the future, Brian D'Souza, also known as Anti-Flow, has a warning about EDM and the essential nature of where electronic music developed, the clubs.
I guess the challenge is to not sanitise it too much, because dance music to me should still be on the edge in the same way that maybe punk music was. It's counterculture, you know, and I think what's happened in the last few years is that it has become sanitised. You know, EDM is a good example of that. You know, to me that's completely the opposite of what dance music was meant to represent. You know, dance music was meant to be a catch-all, welcome-all kind of thing where everyone could come to the party, you know, everyone was equal. Everyone was welcome, whereas a lot of the EDM and the more commercialised dance scenes, firstly, they're very prohibitively expensive because the DJs demand such high fees, all the costs are massive. Second of all, it's not to do with this collective experience of immersing yourself in the music, because the music is so hectic and designed around capturing your attention every like 30 seconds. It's got to be like something completely monumental going on in the music. A great house club playing house music all night, you know, you have this communal experience, you have a very internal experience as well. You don't have to be entertained, you don't have to have a lyric, vocal, chorus, hook, verse, blah blah blah. It is just having space to be yourself.
You've been listening to some opinions, anecdotes and stories from the history of dance music in Scotland. I'm Vic Galloway, and next week in the final episode of The Story of Scottish Pop, I'll be talking to the great and the good who've produced some of the best alternative and indie music to come from Scotland. Emma Pollock, Alex Kapranos and Aidan Moffat are just some of the people who'll help me explore the alternative edges of Scotland's pop. Yeah.